In Australia, 38,000 people are reported missing every year. Thankfully, most of them are found within 3 months. But over 2,600 people become long-term missing persons. Their cases remain unsolved, and their families are often left in the dark about what happened to them forever. Mark Wern is the father of one of those people, Belinda Peasley, who went missing from Katoomba in New South Wales in September 1998. Belinda's case has been the centre of the latest Unravel true crime podcast on the ABC. Mark, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're very grateful for your time. It's been 21 years since Belinda went missing. What have those years been like for you?
A continuous wondering, for want of a better way of putting it. We didn't know what happened in the beginning, and we're no closer to a solution, a conclusion, or any information that's happened to her 20 years later.
And Mark, how did you feel about the initial investigation immediately after Belinda went missing?
It was very poor. Even the police themselves admit that they made a lot of mistakes, and that was being polite for them.
And do you feel that that was related to the circumstances in which she went missing?
In the days, in those days, the police took the attitude of, oh, well, it's just another junkie gone missing, one less we have to worry about. Today, they tell me that the missing persons unit works entirely different, but back then, that's the way it was. And even their own investigators said that it was a paltry investigation, which is, I really think, a polite way of putting it.
And has the way they speak to you about Belinda changed over the years, Mark?
It did for quite a while. It took me 7 years of arguing and fighting with the police to actually get it in front of a coroner. Once the coroner, I can't recall his name, from Westmead, directed that assets, as he called them, be put on the case, things improved. And I did have a lot of contact with detectives in the years, I suppose, 7 to 14. But since the homicide squad's taken over, they're very aloof. They only tell me what they want me to know. I'm not sort of kept in the loop, if you want, as much as I used to be back, as I say, in years 7 to 14. The detectives back then told me things, not names or specific destinations, but they gave me a rough idea what they were trying to do. And it sort of gave me confidence that they were actually doing something.
And Mark, there's been some new information released just very recently. Did developments of that kind make it easier or harder for you?
I've got to a stage of the whole case where I am pessimistically optimistic, if you can understand that. Yes, it might happen, but, you know, I hope it does, but, and there's always that but tacked on the end of it.
And you're listening to Life Matters with Mark Wern, whose daughter Belinda Peasley went missing in 1998. Also joining us today is Sarah Whalen. She has a PhD in issues around trauma and the missing, and she's the former manager of the Families and Friends of Missing Persons Unit at the New South Wales Department of Justice. She's just released some updated guidelines with the AFP about how police and other services can better support the families of long-term missing persons. Sarah, welcome to Life Matters. Now, you heard Mark talk about his experiences. Tell us about the role of hope for people who are left behind.
Thanks, Hilary. Look, I think in Mark's short overview of what it means to live 21 years later really captures the complexity of what it means to be left behind when someone's missing. So he talked about the engagement with the police, how years 7 to 14 were good, how he's had to interact with other people over time, and that he's cautiously optimistic about things. And what I found, I mean, I've been working with families of missing people since 2004, is that there is both a space of hopefulness and hopelessness that is the pervading experience for people left behind. And I think traditionally in our community, we think about hope being solution-focused or something positive. But a lot of the families that I interviewed for my PhD and the associated research I've done since then demonstrated that hope is really problematic, that it's painful, that it raises people's expectations. And then when those expectations aren't met, that there's almost like a hope hangover that families have. So when the media gets involved, people are hoping, with fingers crossed, that their worlds will shift, that their loved one will be brought back, and that their life will return to what life might have been like before they went missing. And it's all of those missed opportunities that have to be dealt with over long periods of time.
You also heard Mark talk about the experience of having the police be quite clinical towards him and standoffish, perhaps. Is that an unusual experience, or does it apply in certain missing persons cases?
Look, it's not an unusual experience. And as you said before, there's, you know, 38,000 people reported missing each year. So that's 100 people a day. And traditionally, the role of the police is to locate the person, not necessarily to be the support person. But what I've noticed over the years, both training the police and doing research, is that there's unintentional support provision that happens from the police perspective. And so families have to wrestle with the idea that they have pinned all of their hope, usually on the investigating officer, to solve this problem for them. And when that's not able to happen, then there's that complex interplay between the police being both the operational focus, you know, searching for the person, but also the person that signifies that they might be able to resolve this loss for them. And that's a complicated relationship.
Yes. Well, I was wondering too, from the police side, is it almost a necessity for them to be a bit emotionless in some cases if they're working on a very long-term, vicariously traumatic case like this?
Look, I think so. I think that there's the need to be objective, and that there's the need to focus on what the facts of the case are. But it also has to be identified that for some families, the police are their only people in their lives that are helping them with this. And so that's been the focus of the updated guidelines. Initially, when we wrote them, it was very much for counsellors. So I wrote the first version of this back in 2007. And the focus then was on how counsellors can better understand ambiguous loss. But what I've learned over the years is that I have to take my blinkers off as well. You know, I think that happens in any professional setting. And we have to think about all of those places where families get support. And that includes the police, it includes counsellors, it includes the media, and it includes the broader community. Because all of those relationships have the potential to make life more difficult or easier for families of missing people.
Mark Wern, I wonder if you would tell us how the experience of having Belinda go missing is different to grieving a death.
Well, the biggest problem is that we had nothing to grieve as physical, and nowhere to go, i.e. your grave, to actually to grieve as well. Everything is just up in the air. And it was interesting, I've spoken to Sarah in the past, and the word she used and the word I use a great deal is frustration. And that's something that I believe, or Sarah explained to me, that all families go through that, and it's something that I virtually live with. That's why I described as pessimistically optimistic. It's just the frustration of not knowing. It's as simple as that.
And Mark, did you feel that there were support services available that could deal with that kind of grief for you?
I don't know. I haven't sought counselling services or anything. I'm sort of old school. I was taught you keep your emotions to yourself. You just stow one foot in front of the other and you deal with what is put in front of you, which can grind you down a great deal.
And Sarah, I'm wondering if there are enough support services that are particularly equipped to deal with these very specific kinds of needs that the families of the missing have.
Mm. Look, I think initially when we started doing research in this space, and Australia is actually at the forefront of understanding the evidence-based strategies to work with families of missing people, despite the fact that there's only two or three researchers, we are world leaders in terms of trying to understand what we can do better. What we found in the early days was that the initial research said that for every one person who goes missing, at least 12 people would be adversely affected. So if you divide that by the 30, or times it, I'm not very good at maths, by the 38,000 people who go missing every year, we're talking about a significant proportion of the population that are trying to deal with an unresolved loss. But what we've found in terms of both talking to families about their experience of reaching out for support and for my role in terms of upskilling counsellors is that a lot of times there's a disconnect. When families reach out for support, counsellors or support people are often saying, oh, I've never come across this type of loss before. And that can be really othering for people. It can make people feel like there isn't someone that has a good handle on the situation that's able to help them navigate through the space.
And the people you spoke to, I think you spoke to 75 people, gave some very, very powerful accounts of what it was like to live with this experience, an all-consuming cumulonimbus of pain, disruption, yes, confusion, doubt and worry, and the fear that will hover over you and your family for the rest of your lives. That's from a sibling of someone who went missing. What did they want to come out of these guidelines when you started doing this research, Sarah?
I always make sure in every research project I do, at the end I say, if you unfortunately had to have your time again, what would you have wanted that was different? And people said that they wanted understanding, that they wanted people to acknowledge that this type of loss doesn't get easier over time. It gets more and more complicated. From my PhD, what I noted from families, and it sounds ridiculous to say this out aloud, but they said that after 10, 11, 12 years, they started to be able to sit with the loss a little bit better. That's a significant period of time. It's like Mark talking about years 7 to 14 were okay, but we're now at year 21. These are whole lives that people are having to live with navigating ambiguity. And what happens, particularly as people get older, is they start to panic about what happens if I pass away and I never find out what happened to my loved one. So they're almost travelling two paths. They're concerned about the safety and well-being of the person who's missing, but they're also worried about themselves. And I think we're incredibly fixated in our community about missing persons investigations. I think we need to look beneath that and we need to think about the ripple effect for people left behind, but also the vulnerability of people who go missing and come back.
Yes, and I think the guidelines have a note about what it might be like to come home as a missing person and the thought that might need to go into that.
Yes, exactly. So it's like my initial focus working in this sector was very much being exposed to the stories of people left behind. And I felt that I couldn't unsee what they were showing me. So that was why I initially started writing down those reflections and why I moved into the research space. But the more I heard the stories, the more I thought about the stories that we're not listening to. And if 38,000 people go missing every year and 95% of those come back, we need to also honour the other side of the story here too. We need to honour Belinda's story as well as Mark's story.
We're chatting to Sarah Wayland, who has a PhD in issues around trauma and loss of people left behind when a person goes missing, and has just updated the guidelines that the AFP use to deal with people who are left behind in these cases. And also Mark Wern, who's the father of Belinda Peasley, who went missing in Katoomba in New South Wales in 1998. Mark, what would you like the guidelines to achieve in the sense of helping other families in your situation?
I don't know. That's a question out of left field. I wasn't thinking of that. The biggest thing is, in my opinion, the very close relatives of missing persons must be included in contact, if you understand what I mean. Exactly what happened to me in, as I said, in years 7 to 14, where detectives didn't give me specifics of what they were doing. But by saying, you know, we're investigating this particular area, or we're going to do this, I sort of had a sense of involvement. With the Homicide Squad particularly, and I know it's their job, and they are in a difficult position, but I've got no involvement whatsoever. You know, in this particular instance, they invited me to the dig on December 3rd last year. Though I was the first to be told that they found something this week just gone. I was the first to be told that they were releasing information regarding particular items of clothing that they'd found. But, you know, from this late December until last week, I don't think there was any contact whatsoever. And the worst thing, again, as I said, I spoke to Sarah, her word is my word, frustration. I was left in total limbo even for those 2 months. And, you know, that's where I've been the whole time. And getting directly to your question, I believe there must be some sort of contact and reassurance, not a pat on the head and, you know, we are doing the best we can, now you just trot off home sort of reassurance, but genuine, that the parents and very close relatives can be involved, even in a minor way.
And Mark, at the end point of this process, is what you're looking for, would you term it closure, or is it a different word that we're looking at?
No, I find closure a very critical word. And I always use the example, go and ask the Morecambe family whether they have closure for Daniel. And they don't. You know, walk past the room and there's a faint smell comes out and the memories come and the tears come. Mm. He had his little dog. The dog will do something and it'll remind them of what the way it used to play with Daniel, and the tears come. What I want is justice for Belinda in every sense of the word. From now until they put the first blade of grass on top of my feet, I won't have closure because I'll never forget her.
And Sarah, I could hear you agreeing with Mark. What would you like the language to be around these cases when you're dealing with family members going through this extremely difficult time?
When I completed the survey last year and we had the 74 families come forward and tell me what was happening for them, the three predominant phrases were closure, acceptance and hope that families found not useful for them. That the families that I've worked with, particularly those long-term missing persons cases where there has been a resolution and a body has been located, families have talked about it being a reunion of sorts, a reunion in terms of reconnecting with the person who was lost and being able to honour them, but also just another element of the investigation. And I think we've used quite passive words today, and I'm often guilty of that too when we talk about loss or we talk about grief. But what we're starting to see is that the families left behind are experiencing trauma. And the trauma is not just relating to the fact that the person's missing. It's the, like you said before, the quote from the participant about a cumulonimbus of pain, about the fact that they're not only just living with the idea of what might have happened to the person, what the police say might have happened, but the 101 other stories that run through their minds when they're imagining where their loved one might be, what pain they might have gone through, how they're exposed to the elements, whether or not someone will be held accountable for what's happened, or whether or not they'll understand why the person intentionally walked away, depending on why the person's missing. So I think we need to almost vacate the idea of missing and loss and grief and talk about this for what it is. It's trauma.
And Sarah, we hope that those updated guidelines will help ease what will never be an easy time for the families. Mark Wern, father of Belinda Peasley, we really appreciate your time today on Life Matters. Thank you. Belinda went missing in 1998. Sarah Whalen's an academic researching the effects on families of long-term missing persons, and you can find more information about all the issues we've been discussing today on the Life Matters website. The latest episode of the Unravel series on Belinda Peasley's disappearance came out on Tuesday. You can search Unravel True Crime on the ABC or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Hilary Harper. You're listening to Life Matters.